Episode 444 with Dr. Frank Gibson is brought to you by some really cool products. One is Barf World Raw Pet Food. I'm telling you guys, if you have an animal, if you have a dog, consider giving this a try. We've had Robert Mueller, the founder of Barf World, on the show a couple times, and Maggie just absolutely loves this diet. She has been on it for a couple of years now, and it's cost effective, and it's so good because it's raw. It's raw meat, and it includes the bone, which is what dogs would normally eat, is the bone, along with the entrails and the organ meats as well. Dogs would never just really eat muscle meat, and Maggie thrives. Her coat is shiny and soft, and she's got endless amounts of energy. She just loves this diet. So if you're interested in giving your dog a try with this Barf World, you can go to extremehealthradio.com/444. And we're also brought to you by the Big Berkey water filters. Now, I know many people have these new refrigerators these days that have filters within them, or a lot of our listeners also go get spring water. But the Berkey is awesome because you can travel with it, and no matter how pre-filtered your water is, if it comes from a spring or a well, you can also put it through the Berkey, which is what a lot of people do. It gets rid of 100% of copper, 100% of arsenic, 100% of strontium, 100% of cadmium, 100% of lead, 100% of uranium, as well as if you get the arsenic fluoride filters, it gets rid of all of that too. And it's awesome because it's gravity fed. And our buddy Mike Adams over at waterfilterlabs.com did an independent study of 12 of the best water filters he could find in his lab there in Austin, Texas. And the Berkey came out number one. And I can say from personal use, we really love ours, and it's great because you can travel with it. They come in different sizes if you have a big family or small. It doesn't use any energy. It's gravity fed, and it's really awesome. And so what's also awesome is that you can put really clean water in there to begin with, and it makes it even better. So I highly recommend the Berkey. Go check out Barf World or the Berkey at extremehealthradio.com/444. There'll be links to both of those products, which I would highly suggest you check out. Thanks for your support, and let's get started with the show. All right, here we are once again. Episode, get this. Kate, you have a little bimby on your...
Oh, am I bleeding?
Yeah. Guess what episode this is?
444.
444. How do you know?
I knew we were getting close, and I was waiting for that triple number.
444. Oh my gosh, it's 9:11 a.m.
Well, there we go.
There, double numbers
They're
everywhere. Jeez, that's crazy, right? Yesterday we were seeing them everywhere. That's amazing. So today we got Dr. Frank Gibson. We're going to be talking about alcohol addiction. And before the show, I pulled up a couple of statistics.
What do you have?
So, 17.6 million adults have alcohol addictions. That's one in every 12 adults suffer some kind of abuse or dependence on alcohol.
In America?
In America.
Okay.
How crazy is that? One out of every 12 is actually addicted. That doesn't mean one out of every 12 drinks alcohol. It's just one out of every 12 is addicted.
Mm.
So, I'm sure it's much higher than that. And get this. 88,000 people a year die from alcohol-related deaths.
Mm.
Isn't that amazing?
Wow.
88,000 people. That's 62,000 men and 26,000 women every single year. That's got to be some kind of fatalities from car accidents and things like that.
Gosh.
Right? Isn't that crazy?
Oh, it's horrible.
Man, oh man.
Horrible.
So today we're going to be talking with Dr. Frank Gibson, and this is really going to be a great episode because I'm excited that I don't think we've really covered this topic before, have we?
Done some addictions, but never specifically alcohol, what it does, why people are addicted, just delving deeper into this.
Yeah, you're
huge
right.
Huge. Subject, really.
Massive, massive, massive.
We all know people, or we are one of those people, and I just think this is going to be a really important subject to cover.
Yes, and before we get started, I want to tell everyone, if you are listening to this, let's see, the same day we post it, or we are recording it, is Monday, July 11th, 2016. We are running a sauna sale currently until Thursday night of this same week at 11:59 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. So if you would like to find out more about the sauna sale, send me an email, justin@extremehealthradio.com. We don't do this very often, and I just want to let everyone know that we are doing that. So if you want to take advantage of this offer, just email me and I'll send you more details and information about that. So Dr. Frank Gibson is a researcher, entrepreneur, medical practitioner, scientific researcher. He's been at this since 1991, or actually probably a lot longer. In 1991, he founded the Millennium Corporation, which became the largest clinic of integrative and oriental medicine in the United States, which is pretty cool. And let's see, he's founded Precious Wood Farm, a 216-acre nonprofit health and educational facility in the mountains of North Carolina. This is really good. So we're going to be talking with him. And his website is Last Call Program. Is that correct? Lastcallprogram.com. So thank you so much, Dr. Gibson, for being on the show today.
Thank you. And thank you for the opportunity to speak with you and your listeners and about the number one health problem in the world. Mm.
Yeah. So how long have you been working with people? Because I know it said you founded the Millennium Corporation in 1991, but you're probably helping people much longer before that, right?
I was, and prior to getting involved in addiction, I spent 6 years researching and trying to develop this type of product. And what it's come down to really is a message. And my message is simply that of hope based on science, and that it is possible for people that suffer from alcohol use disorders to restore their life and their health. And I'm very good at getting at the root of the problem. And when I see that people understand why they have this disorder, and I see that awakening, that realization that they actually can change their lives, that, I mean, it's amazing. And then I do my best, and always have, to help people stay with that commitment and attain success. And as you mentioned, the 17.6 million Americans, I'm very passionate about bringing this message to the 17.5 million people who need this, especially the 15 million, and that's the real point, Justin, is the 15 million that don't ever seek treatment. Obviously, most of those in need have given up on the standard old, you know, practices that we used for addiction for years, and actually only 4% of them believe that treatment will do any good for them. Mm-hmm. We really need to get this message out to people that there have been significant changes.
So what are the main, I know there's the 12-step, is that sort of the main one people go to? Do we not want to mention names?
I think there's a wide variety. I mean, there's moderation management, there's the AA, there's certainly the very expensive and inexpensive treatment centers. But in a study that we did, we found that out of 974 treatment methods, that all but 3% use something to do with a 12-step program. And, you know, so what we have is a system of medicine that is based on a worst case first. This is a different approach than any other form of medicine. You know, if you have hypertension, your doctor says, hey, you know, let's look at your diet, let's try this, do a little exercise, and then eventually you might have to get drugs or multiple drugs. We start with the worst case first, in most cases with addiction. We stick them into what used to be called asylums. They go into a treatment center, they're out 4 weeks, and then we turn them loose to some support group. It's not medicine.
What was the asylums all about? Just complete detox and just getting no alcohol in you at all and just drying out completely?
The idea is that they have to detox, and then they keep you away from alcohol long enough that your body may start to change. You know, unfortunately, we have great drugs out there now. We have Camprasate, we have Naltrexone. We have drugs that have been in use for decades and are proven to work. They're not great. They may have a 15% success rate, but you know what? If that was my mom and she had a 15% versus basically not that good in most other programs, I mean, they're just not using them. They're not changing. In fact, the former director of the National Institute of Alcohol Abuse and Alcoholism, Dr. Mark Willingbring, quit his 25-year post as chief psychiatrist and researcher because they weren't doing it. He's actually setting up his own treatment center and own treatment protocol. We have to, you know, we have the science, and we have to see that this can change. And if we can't help people do this, they're just lost, and they're not going into treatment. And AA is at sort of a balance point. As many people almost quit every year as those that join. So people are just, I mean, it's so unbelievable. And as you mentioned, everyone knows someone with this problem. You're seven times more likely to know someone with alcohol use disorder than you are to know a school teacher.
Isn't that gross?
Wow. So
yeah, I mean, that kind of puts in perspective, doesn't it?
Yeah. So I mean, we you know, Kate and I have lots of friends that have alcohol issues, or not lots of friends, but just a couple.
And I've lost a few from it too. So yeah, it's everywhere.
It's everywhere in our culture. The DUIs, you know, that according to insurance actuaries, before a person gets a DUI, on the average, they've driven 78 times drunk.
Oh my gosh.
And so 15.1% of Americans have had a DUI in the past 12 months. In Wisconsin, it's 24%.
So what is the traditional success rate with many of these normal, sort quote, normal treatment centers? Like you said before, just a second ago, that just as many come back in as leave, you know? So what is the success rate typically?
You know, it's something, Justin, that I really try to avoid, because I applaud anybody that does it. I applaud that anybody, whether it's a psychologist on a street corner or down Main Street, or it's Betty Ford Clinic. If people get help, fine. But, you know, we're failing to move forward with a new addiction. I brought a couple of quotes here that are mind-boggling, and so maybe people can understand. I want to encourage people today to go out and look. We have so much stuff on the internet, but you can go to the National Institute of Health, the National Institute of Alcoholism, Abuse and Alcoholism. You know, Nora Volkow, the director of the National Institute on Drug Abuse, stated, many Americans today, I'm reading a quote, do not yet understand why people becoming addicted to drugs, or how remarkable scientific advances are literally redefining the arena of addiction. Groundbreaking discoveries about the brain have revolutionized our understanding of addiction, enabling us to respond effectively to the problem. Columbia University says the vast majority of people in need of addiction treatment do not receive anything that approximates evidence-based care. Only a small fraction of individuals receive interventions or treatment consistent with scientific knowledge about what works. How do you think someone who's tried with all their heart to be successful in these programs feel when they're not successful? Is it the treatment center's fault? You know, we've had advances in medicine that happen so fast. You don't look like you're old enough to have gone through it, but polio was terrifying, and it was over in one day. You know, one day everybody lined up and got the vaccine. Depression. Millions and millions and millions of Americans suffered depression. It was horrible. They went in asylums. They got lobotomies. They got shock therapy. It was horrible. And one day we have Prozac and 23 million prescriptions. And, you know, these are scientific advances. Tuberculosis, look at the history of that. It's been around. They found traces of tuberculosis in Egyptian tombs 9,000 years ago. These things, that was over in a day. I mean, oh, okay, we've got a cure for this now. We have this science, and it's just going to take some time for people to catch up with it. Because treatment centers, I have to, you know, I'm not cynical about it, but they are ingrained in a treatment protocol that's financially based. They're, you know, if you have a hotel, you have to have certain occupancies. Mm-hmm. And they're not using the new medicine. And everybody in science is confused as why they're not using these.
Well, think about also the people that go, that, you know, finally decide to check themselves into a treatment center like this, and they try it out, and typically they're probably drinking because they're depressed in some sense of how their life is. And then they figure, okay, I need to get help. I need to get help. I need to get help. They go to a treatment center, and then it doesn't work for them. And then they think it's probably them. There's something wrong with them. Mm-hmm. They're alcoholic.
Yes.
When that happens, they get more and more depressed after that, because they think it's their fault, you know?
And so does their family. And so do their friends.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And here's a great thing from the New York Times writer Jane Brody. In a New York Times personal health report, she wrote, if you have failed one or more times to achieve lasting sobriety after rehab, perhaps spending thousands of dollars, you are not alone. And chances are, it's not your fault.
Mm.
And to help people understand that, and, you know, this simple explanation of what we now know is going on in the brain, and how we, you know, it's not a funny subject, But I heard a comedian once say that alcoholism is the only disease you can get in trouble for. Nobody says, damn, Billy, you have lupus? No. And, you know, and we have, if you're hypoglycemic, and you need sugar. You have to have sugar because you could have a stroke. You're going to get tremors. You're going to get, you know, confusion. You're going to have all these symptoms.
Right.
Actually, they're very similar to alcohol withdrawal symptoms. But nobody says, you can't have any orange juice. No, you can't have any sugar. They don't hide the sugar because it's a body change. And that's what we now know about addiction and the relief that people find. When they come across the information that says, hey, you know, your body is just not doing it. I mean, ask the question. 80% of the people, this came up before, you said, is that number the total number of people use? No, of course, 1 out of 12, no, that's the people but that have a problem. But 80% of Americans enjoy alcohol as a healthy, normal part of life. So in their lives, alcohol is an addition to enhance meals, good times, not an addiction. And yeah, once in a while they drink more than they should, but generally they don't have a problem. What we know now is what's different in the brain of people who just can't do that and shouldn't go do that. Mm. And it's what we know. And we also know, and this is what's really key, and this is the message that we can spread, it now can be reversed. We know it can be reversed.
So what goes on in
That was my question. What's happening in the
brain?
Yeah,
what goes on physiologically? I know it's a complete whole body imbalance, but to me it seems like it's a primarily maybe like a liver, gut, brain issue.
Well, to begin with, some people have a difference in their brain that predisposes them to have an abnormal reaction to alcohol. And as alcohol becomes more consistent in the body, chemical events start to occur in the brain that brings about this abnormal reaction. And so basically you have neuroadaptation taking place in brain circuits. And I think one of the problems in getting this message across to people is that it's neurology, and we all had that stuff in college, but you know, it's kind of most people, you pass the test. It's not, these aren't common terms. And when I write articles, when I speak about it, I try to do it in a way that people understand. So let me tell you about the marbles is in the brain. You want me to do that?
Yeah, please.
Okay. This is how I've come down to, simply explaining. And it was funny because I sent a friend of mine who's a founder of a very large company who had a problem years ago, and he's heard talk to me, and it's been 11 years since I helped him with his alcohol use disorder, and I sent him some things from when I was working on my book, and he called me and he said, hey, I got to tell you, Frank, I've been faking it for 11 years. And I said, what do you mean? He goes, well, you talk to me and I shake my head and I think I'm kind of stupid because I really did understand what you were saying about all this brain stuff. He said, but my gosh, the marbles, you got it. You know, I understand. So here's what we have. We have the brain knows it's got these two bowls of marbles and it's supposed to keep them both exactly balanced. And let's say one of these marbles is, it says gas on it, and the other one says brakes. And so now they're in perfect balance. And the brakes one has, as we call it, GABA, G-A-B-A. It's gamma-aminobutyric acid. And the other one is the accelerator, and that's glutamate. So as you continue to drink excessively, maybe you're just fine. Maybe you had a little bit of this imbalance when you're born, but as alcohol becomes more consistent in the body, these chemical events start to change. And all of a sudden, you got one more marble over in the gas, you know, accelerator in your car.
Mm-hmm.
And then you don't necessarily have less of the GABA, of the brakes, but you get more and more. And you keep drinking and you keep drinking and your body's changing and neurophysiologic differences are occurring and you're getting more and more marbles. So now you got your body's more on the gas pedal. And you mentioned, Justin, the whole body experience. And I see that you understand the interrelation in the body. This isn't just the brain. You're right. The liver, other aspects of things that we're so interconnected in our bodies. Yet these two chemicals are now you have more and more and more marbles and the gas pedal is down more and you can't put the brakes on. And what happens is the body thinks because alcohol inhibits, let's say it masks its ability to tell how to determine how much of the gas pedal marbles it has. So it keeps making more.
Mm.
And as it makes more, it's fine as long as you're consuming some alcohol. But then you get up one morning and go, man, I'm not doing that again. And you pull off the alcohol. Now you're not inhibiting the marbles and the gas pedal, right? And they're off to the races. Now you got all these are actually neurotransmitters, marbles. Mm-hmm. You got bunches of them just waiting to fire up because they were inhibited. The body had no idea it had so many of them, so it just kept making them. Mm-hmm. And then there it goes. And it's off to the races, and you literally, that's what detox is. That's the withdrawal and the tremens and the all the stuff that goes on, even hallucinations are all because. So when this person says, I'm not going to do it anymore, his body's like, just like a diet, like someone that's hypoglycemic.
Right.
It's screaming for sugar, right? Instead, it's screaming for alcohol. If you give me some alcohol, you're going to be just fine. Mm-hmm. This is what the brain is telling. This is with every ounce of intellect and everything possible. This is basically what the brain is saying. Get me some alcohol.
So when someone goes into a detox situation and they go into a center and stay and dry out for 3 or 4 or 5 weeks or however long, at the end of that, what is the situation with in relation to what you were just saying with the marbles and all of that? Has their body recalibrated at that point?
No. In detox, we use barbiturates, we use benzodiazepines, both of which inhibit GABA and mm-hmm. drive glutamate. I mean, the only thing that's accomplished is your body now can exist. You know, you're free of these symptoms, free from alcohol, but you have not changed the brain chemical balance. And so it becomes a fight. And I've sat with so many thousands and thousands of people and their families and wondered how they even made it through this fight for so. It's a fight that everyone around us says, why don't you just give it some willpower, you know. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, they can't. It's like it'd be like telling someone with a stroke to go run a mile. I mean, to me, that's it. Now, this doesn't mean that to some degree you can say, oh, these people are completely off the hook that suffer. Yeah,
right.
No, you could find all kinds of reasons if you want to, but that's not what we're trying to do. We're trying to help people. I try to work on so much on helping the families understand and helping the families change so that they address it like a disease. I mean, my gosh, if the guy had a stroke, no one's going to say, man, you messed up my life, you know? Well, you had a stroke, and it's the truth. A stroke changes life's plans for a family, but you don't blame the person.
Well, it's a really good analogy, I think, that you had with someone being diabetic, where they have to get that insulin. You know, they have to have it. Like, their body's screaming out for it, and it's probably the same way with alcohol. It's just a really good analogy because, like you said, at some point there is a culpability issue. People do choose in certain actions, but at another level, physiologically, their body's just screaming like it needs and requires something like alcohol.
Yes, you know, they may have already gotten there because of bad choices, because mm-hmm. of too much drinking, because of going out and got to the disease. But you know what? A diabetic may have gotten there from, you know, inherent birth genetics, or because they just had a really horrible diet, or they're obese or whatever. So, but the point is what are we trying to do here? We're not trying to place blame or figure out how they got there. We have to get the message out to people that we know how you got there and we know how to get out of there. Now, there's discussions actually among treatment centers. If we could lock someone away for 90 days and a year, sometimes as much as 2 years of no alcohol before these brain chemicals come in balance.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So, I mean, for some people, it's easier. For some people, they could maybe stay away from alcohol for 6 months, even as little as 3 months, but you can't bet your life on it.
What do you think about that whole thing that I see with AA, and they say, you know, I knew my mom's friend for many, many years, I think went to AA I think she got off alcohol and, you know, for 30 years of her life, but every week she'd go to one of these AA meetings and she would always tell my mom, you know, she's an alcoholic and kept proclaiming that. I just find that to be a little bit strange where you continually attach yourself to this idea that, you know, this is who you are. It's kind of bizarre.
Yeah. I've thought my way through that a lot. And I've never, you know, it's funny. People say, oh, did you have a big, why'd you get so interested in this? And, mm-hmm. you know, I never really had a problem. I was always an athlete and a martial artist. And it was nothing that, it was something, I mean, I enjoy wine. I really like it. But glass and I'm fine. So why I got into this is just really because it seems like we've built a huge system and people aren't getting help. And I appreciate what goes on in AA, but you're right. I know a lot of people that have a hard time. I don't know that I could achieve success in anything if I'd start out by saying I was a weakling.
Mm-hmm. Right.
That I'm powerless. You know, we're not. We have power that comes to us from many, many sources. Mm-hmm. And we have to be able to connect with that power. And living in an environment where, you know, people are constantly assuming that you're a loser and treating you as such. I mean, you know, this is the 36% of the people don't seek treatment just for that reason, social stigma.
Oh,
they
wow.
hide it. We've had people come to our lab to buy something to help them in the plane. They don't walk in a medical office. We have to find a way to help people so they can go to their doctors and demand these things. I mean, there are drugs out there that aren't being used. Sanjay Gupta had Betty Ford and Hazelton CEOs on his program, and he's going, "Why aren't you using these new drugs?" Well, mm-hmm. Then they're really not new. They were in Europe for 10, 15 years before they even got here. And yes, the success rates aren't high, but as I said, and they were like, well, you know, and he pulls up brain images and he says, look, we've got pictures now. We know exactly what's going on in the brain. And we do. And it's frustrating. 23-year veteran of chief of research, left the NIAAA because he's fed up. He's going to do it right. Mm-hmm. And so where's that going to come? Polio, people lined up the next day. But there's articles in the paper and there's little pieces of things and people come across and it's so confusing and no one's talking in marbles. You know, they're talking in neurotransmitters and right. these big terms. And like, you know what? If you run into somebody that you know that has AUD and you say, you know, there's really help out there. Go look, start researching, find out. You know, people don't even know that this is available. And I've had people tell me that, Scott, I talked to you and then I talked to somebody I knew had a problem and it was crazy. If you give people hope, if you tell them they can actually, you know, run 10 miles and they start to believe it, they'll do it. Otherwise, why would they do it?
Yeah.
And that's why work that you people do is so critical, because it's almost like a grassroots. It's almost like, hey, here's some stuff. Go out and look at it. Look at it more. You can do this.
Mm-hmm.
And people are losing that feeling in too many ways. And in addiction, you know, it's not fair to the families to say it's not their fault. But the point is that you can't go to, and you asked me about success rates, and I don't like to comment on them because any success is good.
Mm-hmm.
But
mm-hmm.
I do comment on the fact that if you're walking around the rest of your life, to use the old term, waiting for the other shoe to drop. And that's what the families do. They're just waiting for decades when this person's going to relapse, because statistically they are.
Mm-hmm.
And could you imagine going around with a sword hanging over your head or, you know, the rest of your life, or trying to go to sleep at night with
this idea that you're always going to be
addicted. Over your head. And these are exact terms that people have said to me that they feel like living, that they're having to live the rest of their life because, oh, you're always an alcoholic. Well, it's simply not true.
Yeah. And one of the things that, I think if I were an alcoholic, if I were someone who really, really was addicted, it would be one thing for someone to say to me, you can overcome the addiction. That would be one side of the coin where I would think immediately, okay, I can somehow have enough willpower my entire life to suppress these addictions I have. Or if someone were to say to me like you know, we can actually change your physiology so you're not addicted anymore. That to me would be so much more appealing, because I'd be like, okay, well, I'm no longer going to have this intense struggle or craving for these things. Is that possible, do you think?
It is possible. And what's great is if you help people, what I do is I take it out of this context and I help them understand how many ways we already do that. I mean, take your kidneys. They can read how much potassium your body needs. And they disperse it or doesn't disperse it in your urine.
Mm-hmm.
You're subjected to cold and flu viruses all the time. What do you get? A couple a year or nothing?
Mm-hmm.
How's that possible? Because your body keeps itself in balance. It's got these little samurai there's a virus. They're zipping down there to keep your body what? In balance.
Right, right.
And we have this happen in all kinds of ways. And in natural medicine, it's more based on the fact that, you know, total body balance. And that's what, and you know, people in science today know, because we know why we have this problem, we also know that it can be restored. If people could get, I mean, you go online and people are selling GABA, you know, unfortunately it's like serotonin. It doesn't pass the blood-brain barrier, but, you know, we know, for example, if the GABA level came up to a certain level and equal with a glutamate, then these people their bodies are restored. They're not going to have unusual cravings. Mm-hmm. And it's possible that 3, 6 months, 2 years, 3 years back, the body may go out of balance. But if you all were going through this and you had this problem, mm-hmm. and you took care of it and you felt your body, you kind of would get aware of your body and you would sense that, hey, you know, I'm slipping a little bit. You know, I actually wanted that third beer. I'm not saying people should drink. You know, probably the best prescription is that people that have had the problem don't. But is that reasonable? No. Mm-hmm. Can you be told, okay, now you guys can't go hang out with your friends anymore in a bar. You can't go to these parties. You know, right. Go get a whole new set of friends that, by the way, you know, believe in abstinence or fight the rest of their lives for abstinence. Right. Right. No, it is possible. And that's the message.
Is that the reason why most people don't, aren't interested? Because they know the struggle so well. They just think that there's no other way. And so they get super discouraged and then just give up.
They do.
Yeah.
They do. Mm-hmm. And they, you know, so many people go through it just the fact it kills me. Drive 78 times before you're caught.
That's shocking.
Isn't that crazy?
It's really shocking. That's insurance tables. That's, I mean, it's shocking. So what happens is people hide the problem and then, you know, they have a bad event and then they kind of can take care of it, but they can't control it. They're being driven by things in their brain. They're in their body screaming for it. And I mean, what a message to be able to say to people, look, go find a new science. At least know that there's a way out. And maybe they don't do it. Maybe there's a, you know, if we had the magic pill in the world and 100% of the people took it and they no longer had unusual cravings for alcohol, I'll bet you there still would be people that didn't go do it. Yeah. But the point is that what's the first step? It's changing the status quo of the treatment centers. We're not going to change AA, and they're helping the people. Mm-hmm. So yes. Fine, let them do their thing. They don't believe that you should take anything. If there was this magic pill, they would tell the people not to take it because they view it as a crutch. As Dr. Willingbring, the doctor I mentioned left the NIAAA, his quote was, you don't treat people for 4 weeks and then shoot them off to a support group. I mean, 4 weeks, really? Yeah. You know, somebody's been drinking excessively for 20 years and you're going to go hopefully do something in 4 weeks. And who can afford to do that? And who can afford to do 6 weeks, 8 weeks, 10? I mean, the whole system is you have to beat the issue of social stigma. You have to beat the issue of, hey, I want my life. I want to be able to drink a little bit. Do you know only 2% of people over 55 have ever sought treatment? Why? Think about it. They're all sitting around, you know, there's what you did in their age group. And it's just people just, I mean, we get 1.6 million people sought treatment of any form last year.
Gosh.
Wow.
Yeah. And it's crazy. And to me, it's such a great message. And, you know, you can tell I've been doing this since I started researching this in 1986. I have I had a way to help people in 1983 and people laughed about it. And then until 2011, the American Society of Addiction Medicine said, yeah, this is a brain chemical disorder. And now everybody's on that page, but the general populace and the people that are suffering from this disease don't know it. What if we had a cure for something else that causes as many deaths as you quoted, mm-hmm. and people didn't know about it? We have to get the message out that, you know, not to go try naltrexone or camphorsafe, but hey, do your work, do your research. There is a way out of this nightmare.
There's a doctor in LA that I heard talking about addiction once, and he was mentioning about how some of his patients, what they try to have them do is have a healthy relationship with alcohol. Because one of the things that I unfortunately, I don't have any addictions to alcohol, and you know, maybe once a month I might have an ounce or two of wine, and yeah. It's fine. But so what he was saying was that you know, it's not necessarily true that everyone needs to do cold turkey, 100% no alcohol. What are your thoughts about being completely alcohol free versus being able to have a good relationship to alcohol?
If you've been an alcoholic, you mean, if you've had a problem?
Yeah, if you've ever had a problem, and you know, do you take that on a case by case basis?
It's case by case to a degree, but we have to look at statistics, and we have decades and decades of statistics. And if you go to the National Institute of Alcohol Abuse and Alcoholism, you've seen they made a shift from abstinence to moderation. Mm. I mean, this is the National Institute of Health. Statements now are saying that, you know, from these government agencies are saying that, you know, hey, let's try to shoot for some moderation, because can we all not just sit down and admit that this experiment in alcohol treatment has been a disaster, and it's not changed since 1950. I mean, I wrote an interesting blog. I'll send to you if you want, but it's sad. You know that they used to sterilize people with alcohol.
Did they really?
Oh my gosh!
I mean, then the next step was to put them into asylums, basically, and lock them away. And I mean, the treatment principles have been horrible. So maybe we haven't done as much harm, but we haven't helped people. I mean, I believe firmly it's a failed experiment. But I'm very cautious to tell people not to do it, because you know what? If 100 go in and 7 come out doing well, that's only 7%. But that could be your brother. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and I mean, just to get people into treatment, we did, you know, it's amazing how people can exist and how long they can go on hiding this problem. I've talked to people who hid their drinking from their wife for, you know, 6-7 years. And, you know, we used to have an image of an alcoholic as a guy in a dirty coat with a flask, and, you know, and he's on.
Right.
You know, it's like, and women, I mean, my gosh, the women never were part of this group, and it's huge, because a woman's body is different. She doesn't have the enzymes that a man has. So if the equal body weight, a woman and a man, the woman can only have half as much alcohol because she can't break it down to the degree the man has. And we're not addressing it. And pregnancy, I mean, over 80% of women are drinking during pregnancy.
No.
It's on every bottle of booze. It's on every bar. I mean, and it's above. And you know who's worse at it? The educated. I mean, it's one. I mean, it's just unbelievable that this problem. And I think people have just become hopeless, and they don't want to change their lives. So to answer your question, I believe that abstinence is the best prescription for somebody who has an alcohol use disorder, mm-hmm. even if they've taken care of it. Given say that, the point is that over 80% of the people who try abstinence fail. I don't care where you go and look at the statistics, that's the number. Now, that's an unfair number to say to people who are out there trying to do good with, whether it's AA or other programs. You have moderation management that helps people get together and control it. But the bottom line is nobody's changing the body. And that's how we have to do it. And you know, there are things that you can take to do it. There are foods you can eat. There is exercises you can do. We have to get this information in front of people, because that's what's going to change the world. And you know, we're not that bad. I mean, South Korea is the worst in the world. I had some experience working with clients, and I did a symposium in Bulgaria, and 93% at the time in 2008, 93% of people under 18 were drunk at least once a week. And, you know, this is going down into the children. You'd have no idea how early children are drinking, tasting their first alcohol at the average of 11.
Mm-hmm. Oh, my gosh. That's all crazy. Around, like, is that a statistic for worldwide or in America?
No, that's for U.S.
Just U.S.?
It's worse. And actually, Israel is the worst.
Is it really?
Well, you look at people like even Italian kids are growing up drinking wine and things, you know. I mean, it's part of their culture.
Mm. Well, and the belief is that they don't have the problem. I mean, this is what people have said to me. They don't have the problem because they start drinking and their body. It's not true. This is what happens. The statistics on how early you start drinking and related to how much of a drinking problem you're going to have later are horrible. Basically, the earlier you taste alcohol, the more likely you are to have an alcohol use disorder later in life.
Mm-hmm. I want to get into some of the things that we can do, like you were just talking about, for people that do feel like they do have a problem. What are some things that they can do starting now?
Well, I think people, most important thing they could do is become aware of how much they consume. And I don't mean walking around keeping a log, but I've been to dinner meetings and, you know, where business and the waiters just walking around filling glasses. I think a lot of times that people drink more than they want. They don't mean to drink more and then get in their car. They go to a party. They just have to really be aware. And if you got a host that's walking around, you know, here's another beer or hitting your wine glass when you're not looking, I think that's different. Because if people have a slight imbalance, that's going to keep pushing them that way the more times they drink excessively, especially women. And so I think one of the first things that I suggest to people to do is if they want to head towards moderation is say, okay, just keep track of it. There's guidelines that have been prepared by the government, which in this case is, you know, I think very, very well thought out and well researched. And so, never drink alcohol without having something to eat. So first of all, don't have an empty stomach and have something to snack on. I don't care if it's pretzels while you're eating. Mm-hmm. Never drink faster than one drink every half hour. Never drink more than 2 to 3 times a week, and preferably not days in a row. And this is part of awareness of people and their alcohol use, especially this idea of eating, snacking, waiting. You order a drink, look at your watch, don't get another one for another half an hour. And then deciding on what your goals are. Why do you want to drink? What is it? What does it do? What are the reasons that you feel like you want alcohol? Personally, I like wine. And I like it with a meal. I might have it 2 times a week. But if someone's filling my glass, I'm kind of like you, Justin. I mean, I'm pretty good after about 3-4 ounces. Mm-hmm. And after that, sometimes I find in my head, I'm thinking, I should drink this. This is really good. I don't want to waste it. But I'm thinking, but then that's part of the awareness. You go, why would I do that? I'm not drunk. I don't even feel the effect of the alcohol, but my body doesn't want me to reach for that glass. And I'll tell you one of the greatest studies that I can send you that in that respect, in terms of being aware, was done at Harvard on a simple isoflavone that's found in a plant. And it was on college students in a naturalistic setting. And I won't really go through the whole process, but it was a well-constructed study. Mm-hmm. And at the end, these college students could have 6 free beers, and they taped them, they weighed the glass, so how much, basically they, at the end of the period of time when they were on this isoflavone, they would pick the glass up more frequently, trying to drink, but the size of their sips reduced. If you made a chart, you know, it would be going up, the number of times it picked up the glass, and the number, you know, size of the sips went down. And at the end of 6 weeks, they were only finishing 2.6 beers. College students, hey guys, you want 6 free beers? 2.6 beers.
Oh my
now
gosh.
That's what,
wow.
That's the body imbalance. Mm. So the other thing is foods, and I know you've done a lot of work with diet and foods, and mm-hmm. and you know, you mentioned liver. I mean, you just we don't need to spend time here because the you know, the USDA has guidelines for what's good for the liver. And we all, you know, it's so simple to go find out what are good foods for the liver. So because the liver is like getting the hit when you take the alcohol. The liver's balancing the enzymes that break down. The liver health is extremely important in terms of moderating alcohol. And we're under so much stress all the time. And what does the body do in stress? It releases chemicals to get us through the stress, but they're not necessarily good. They aren't good. The body has to get rid of them. So the liver strains. It increases the blood in the portal veins so it can run these, you know, endorphins and other chemicals that are balancing the stress. See, this is part of the natural homeostatic principle that we know now in science is the way to get this brain back into balance. So the liver has had to steal blood from other organs so it has extra blood to change these chemicals because it has to convert them into water-soluble molecules. Can't disperse them because they're fat-soluble. So mm-hmm. all these imbalances start building up. So simply people say, well, I don't want to go to treatment. I don't want to buy this. Fine. You know, you start following these steps. You go to the NIAAA websites and you look at what are guidelines for drinking moderately. They're there. But how many people are getting them? Anybody going to put these on the front page of Lifestyle Magazine? newspaper? I don't think so. So there are things that people can do, because you know what? Almost everybody wants to continue drinking. Mm-hmm. I would say of my experience, and we've done surveys on this internally, is that of the people that have balanced their bodies and are drinking moderately, their choice is that, you know, in the beginning, I'm never going to drink again. But ultimately, about 75% of people would prefer to continue drinking, no matter what happened. I mean, they really feel like it's something. And once they understand, they control it. So let's say you knew how to keep your body in balance, and either through the things we're, you know, you're drinking in balance, through the things we're talking, and we made up a term called balanced alcohol intake, and it mm-hmm. just means you look at all these factors. So if you started picking up the third beer, or, you know, where I typically want 3 or 4 ounces of wine, if I start drinking more, what should I do as a responsible drinker? I should, you know, I should go pay more attention. And until I don't want to do that, or not drink for a week or two, until I don't want that third beer, or I don't want to finish that alcohol. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, the bodies, and I know you both understand this, the body's natural homeostatic principles are just, it's astounding, mm-hmm. all the mechanisms that are going on. It's also astounding how easy it is to throw them out of balance.
Well, you brought up a good point, too, a couple minutes ago about why are people seeking alcohol, you know? You know, some people reach for a glass of wine after a hard day and feel like, I deserve this. And people are listening to this right now thinking, yep, I know that feeling very well, because you justify your decisions and you feel like you need a little bit of an escape. And then there's also people that use it as a way to celebrate. You know, they have a birthday party or they have a family celebration. And, you know, and so I think part of that too is realizing, okay, what is the reason, the mechanism why I'm reaching for this? Is this a celebratory act, or is this a drowning my sorrows act?
Well, and there's sleep. Mm-hmm. A good percentage of people in my experience use it because they can't sleep. You use it for stress release. And the other thing is you obviously, you both don't have this problem, but there are a lot of people. You know, the story that people would, the worst thing in the world to them is getting up in front of people. That's the biggest fear among people, is speaking, being in front of people. Mm-hmm. So there is a huge factor in people who use that to ease social situations.
Right.
To feel more at ease, to be able to be more congenial. Mm-hmm. So you're right. But the track you're on is, I believe, I agree with you, is let's determine what is driving you to do that, and what other things can we do in our lives to balance that. If it's stress, can we find, you know, a meditation or yoga or stress release practices or foods that contribute to stress release? If it's sleep, can we, you know, change patterns, maybe not watch some blow it up movie right before you go to bed, or have a bad phone call? I mean, can we, this is where you're headed, right? That we can do things that if once we identify it, that we can meet those needs in other ways than alcohol.
Yeah, it's such a huge issue, because it requires people to sort of take stock of their life. Because like you said, I mean, I just gave two scenarios of someone who just, you know, after a stressful day, or someone who wants to celebrate, in the two different instances there. But you're also talking about public speaking, social situations. And so it requires someone to take really, I think, a stock of their life and say, okay, if I'm required to give public speeches and I really don't like it, I've given, you know, 10 or 15 speeches, I just don't like it. It's not me. So what can I do to, you know, talk to my boss or talk to someone and say, you know, I'm not going to do this anymore, or I'm not going to do whatever it is that causes me to reach for that alcohol. I need to change this aspect of my life. And that's sort of an issue that people don't want to tackle, because it does require some sort of mechanism of looking inside and changing your life in other aspects.
Yeah, and this makes me, I mean, I want to ask you, so this might lead people to say, you know, I recognize this problem that I have with alcohol, but I don't want to do this. I mean, how do we help people make that shift? This baffles me, right? I mean, how do we help people make the shift to actually do these small things before it becomes a big problem? I mean, I'm not someone that likes to hand out threats, but the fact is, we all know they're going to get a DUI. They're going to wreck their car. They're going to do something really stupid. They're going to damage their relationship. They're going to damage their job. It's, mm-hmm. it's no secret. I don't see it as an approach to get people to do things, but how can we help people make these small changes and increase awareness?
Yeah, I think it just starts with, I personally, I think it just starts with making small little changes in other aspects of your life. Because if you feel like alcohol, this is just my opinion, if you feel like alcohol is sort of gaining more control over you than you would like, then I would say that someone should maybe look at the other aspects of their life that they can have control.
Right.
Do you hate your job every day? So they feel success.
Exactly. Right. Yeah. If you can feel little bits of success, because ultimately when people are drinking, maybe they don't feel successful, or maybe the general underlying tone or sentiment of someone who drinks is a little bit of depression. And so when you feel like, okay, in this other aspect of my life, whether it's, you know, speaking with people at work and people don't respect what I have to say, or becoming someone who people do respect, or whatever it is, if you can find other aspects of success in your life, maybe you can figure out whatever that equation is and apply it to eventually something like alcohol, where you feel like you have no success. Just an idea.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. It's like a baby taking its first step. I did an article once on how many times a baby falls, and it's the success of that first step.
Oh, really?
That keeps them going. Look it up sometime. I don't remember the number, but it's insane how many steps a baby, how many times they'll fall, and just keeps going. And so, yeah, you're right. And then what I liked about what you said is something they can do something about, because they can't immediately do anything about these brain chemicals, but they can, like, go to bed a little earlier. They can time their drinks. I mean, there are things they can do. They can make other positive health problems. And you're right. I mean, I think depression is a big, big part of it.
And I think also, too, with people that are radically addicted, I mean, ultimately, they know they're addicted and they just won't admit it. So I think that when someone is addicted, and you can really allow someone to have control, because what's ultimately they want is sort of, they're lacking control in their regular life. And so they want to be a little bit out of control so that they can somehow have a better impression on people socially or whatever. If you can figure out a way for people to have control over different aspects of their life, because that way, if you feel like, you know what, I can control, I can have an influence or an impact on how I respond to certain things, and then roll that over to the things that you have no control over, like what you were just saying, brain chemistry. Someone can't fix that right away, but they can become successful and they can become a winner in other aspects of their life. And I think that will just carry over. I mean, that's a small part of it, but I think that can carry over.
Wow, I think that's profound. Basically, they're out of control in everyday life. You give them something that they can. Yeah, I once read a Chinese proverb that says it takes 3 years to build a good habit and 1 second to break it.
Oh my gosh, that's good.
Yeah.
And then it's really bad if you're attached to that habit. Like, I'm an alcoholic, and like you said earlier in the show, that the family's just waiting for you to break it. And as soon as they have one drink, they have 10 drinks because they think I'm a failure and I've failed, when in actuality, you know, they just had one drink. They don't have to have the other nine. They don't have to fail at other things, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. So I want to learn a little bit about, have you written a book, right, that could help people a little bit? If people are listening to this, they can get access to a book that you wrote?
Yeah, the most important part of it, it can be a sort of condensed version. It's just 30 pages of the book, and it doesn't have all the heavy science, but I've had such great, you know, we put it up so people could download and read it and for free. And it just gives people, I think, a real sense of how they get out of here. It's sort of like a map of a pathway that's really not that hard. And it's really positive. And as I said, when I started, the fact when people realize, wow, there's a reason I have this. This isn't, you know, I'm not a loser. I went through a treatment center, but they didn't do anything to address my physiological problem. So this is good news for me. There's still hope. I spent my family's $30,000, you know, and so, but it wasn't my fault. And I think it's important to know that. And that's why I wanted to put this kind of condensed version of the book out for free. It's the full version isn't out yet, but it does. I mean, it's great for people. If they want to really understand this and understand the marbles and all the rest of it, and, you know, there's enough, scientific language and neurology in it that they, you know, they can take it another step if they want, but it's simple. And you know, what I really hope the most is that it conveys my passion for wanting to help solve this problem, because it's the root of so many other problems that we face in our culture.
Mm-hmm. Would this be something that would be beneficial for someone who feels like they do have a problem with alcohol, which is what I'm assuming, or would this be better maybe for someone, or just as good for someone who is a friend or a loved one of someone who has an alcohol issue?
I've had reports from all of those groups. I've had reports from families going, I have to change the way I'm treating this person. I understand now how I need to do this. And then I've had it from people who were, they're like, you know, one guy recently said to me, he says, you know, I don't really feel like I need to go to an addiction center, but I kind of know I'm headed for trouble, but I'm right in the middle and, you know, blah, blah, blah. I can't risk my job and quit for 30 days, et cetera. And then I've had people who like really knew their problem, mm-hmm. and have gone into treatment and failed. And for all those groups, it brings the focus back to one thing. We just need to put the appropriate amount of love into the people we're dealing with.
Mm-hmm. Now, if someone's listening to this and they feel like they do have an alcohol addiction that's growing, you know, larger than what they would like, do you work with people, or do you have a program, a physical location people can go to, or how does that work?
We did. We started a program after I created my product to help people. We did it in clinics. We had we eventually expanded to 14 medical clinics, state licensed clinics in the Southeast area, and it got so popular that we couldn't handle it. We had people lining up, and so we gave people, which they never got until they came, we gave them the product called Sobrexa, and then they showed up. You mentioned our lifestyle retreat center in the mountains of North Carolina. They would come there for a 5-day pre-treatment experience and then go into clinics. Well, these people got it before they came, and most of them were reporting that, you know, 3-4 weeks since they took it, the changes started. So this helped us realize that to really overcome this problem, you have to have low cost, you have to have complete anonymity, and you have to have at home. Mm. And I know that sounds ridiculous, and it did to me to begin with. But the first year we made this available, we dropped the price from $7,500 in our clinics to, hey, we'll send this to you in a brown box and do it yourself. Mm. And I was terrified about the success rate. But we had over 3,300 people utilize it in the first year, and with astounding success rates. And so I think we really revolutionized the treatment experience in that way, for people to be able to have low cost at home, completely anonymous. The three reasons that people don't seek treatment. We found our clients who reported they got into treatment 55% earlier before trouble came to their lives. Half the time their families were surprised, didn't even know they were, you know, heading that way. So that's what we do. You know, people are so reluctant to go into treatment. We don't have the treatment. We closed all the treatment, all the medical offices that were doing the treatments, and we just focused on giving good support and talking to people. And, you know, we're not counseling them. If they want to call up, they can talk to me. They can. I mean, people do. I answer all my emails that I get every day, and we just really try to support people through this heartbreaking disorder. And the product does work really well. And, you know, I intended to actually speak less about the product than I'm doing, because I really want the message out there. You know, they'll find our product. We're very, you know, prominent out there. And but we've got to help find some way for people to know there's a way out. If they choose our product, great, because actually it is the highest efficacy of any product out there. But, you know, my mission in life, and I wouldn't be working at all if I was selling widgets or anything else. My mission in life is to start with people need to know, hey, there is a way out. There is something out there.
Yeah.
And if it's the simple steps that you and I have talked about, and the really good ideas that you've come up with for people to just look at the problem and say, whatever method it is, we've got to help encourage them and give them some hope. And if they find our program, it's called the Last Call Program, and you mentioned the website, and the product is Sobrexa. There's another product there, and it helps them deal with stress. It's quite phenomenal. There's no sedatives in it, and, you know, people actually continue buying that after they go through the program successfully, because everybody's got a lot of stress in their life.
It's funny, because the way you say that, I like the idea that those three pillars you talked about, anonymous and
low cost at home.
Yeah, I really like that a lot. And I'm also wondering, I have no idea with how other programs work, but I do know that they there's a big focus on having a sponsor and being regularly admitted every single week to a meeting with other people for support. Is that something that...
Yeah, we're kind of old-fashioned.
What do you think about that?
We have a really nice client guide that was put together in pieces over 23 years of doing this. A lot of it by people who went through the program and contributing their ideas and what they thought. So it's a nice little client guide, and we're old-fashioned in the sense that we think that family's the place to do this. And we, you know, maybe your dad or your mom are a little hardcore, or you know, you can't. But there's somebody in a family, a brother, a sister, an aunt, an uncle. And so we suggest that they, you know, we have some guidelines, we have a little workbook, and they can go talk to, you know, we suggest they do spend one day a week, you know, talking about certain things and discussing, and we give them subjects and we give them topics. You know, if it's a whole family, there's 10 of them, but the thing that we encourage the family to do is really become familiar with the program and how it works, and get involved in a way that's supportive and loving, rather than, you know, I mean, nobody ever succeeded through these, you know, really hardcore. Now, you know, if the guy's abusive and he's going to damage your family, yeah, you got to get him out of the house. But, you know, basically that's not been our experience most of the time. And the ones that do work with family or a close friend or you know, other relative, it really does. I think it is necessary. But I don't know. I'd have a hard time recommending other support groups because there's no controls on it. You might have a great one around the corner and somebody in Topeka might have a horrible one. So, you know, you really can't recommend it. But we know that there's usually, you know, things in a family that can work if everybody can put everything aside and keep their mind on the goal.
Mm-hmm.
Great.
Well, thanks for spending your time for us today. I really appreciate it. And the website is lastcallprogram.com. And I think at the very bottom, at least as the way it's designed now, lastcallprogram.com, at the very bottom, there's an area where you can download the ebook that Dr. Gibson was talking about. You can just put your email address in there. And I'm assuming you'll send it right away to people?
Oh, yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Great.
Well, awesome. Thank you so much. Mm-hmm. And I love your heart too. You know, you really just want to get the information out there and let people know that they are empowered and they're not just victims. And I really like that piece of what you're saying.
Yes. You've really captured it.
Yeah. Thank you so much. Stay on the line there, Dr. Gibson. And we're going to just close out the show. And I want to let everyone know that if they want to listen to this particular podcast on the website, it is extremehealthradio.com/444, and we'll have links to Dr. Gibson's website, which is lastcallprogram.com. We appreciate you guys so much. If you know anyone who has an issue with alcohol, please do us a favor and send them this particular podcast, because you know, they may find help elsewhere or in 20 years, but if you can be somewhat of a catalyst and helping people
find hope again.
Find hope. Yeah.
It's all about hope.
It's all about having
message.
Hope. Yeah. And I like the tagline on lastcallprogram.com. It is reduce alcohol cravings, restore well-being, which is cool.
And isn't that exactly what the yin yang should be?
I know, right?
It's beautiful.
Good stuff. All right, everyone. Thank you so much. And we'll catch you guys on the next episode. Episode 444, Dr. Frank Gibson out in North Carolina.
You know what I love? I got to get to North Carolina.
North Carolina.
Looking at this photo.
On their website.
On his website. Whoo, do those mountains look amazing.
Look at that. Last
call program is your answer made from nature in the mountains of North Carolina. Whew, that looks like God's country, doesn't it?
It does. I wonder what's better, South Carolina or North Carolina?
I'm going to vote North. Just kidding.
Have you been to either one or no?
No, I haven't.
Yeah.
But looking at that, I don't know if you could get much prettier than that.
They have some great islands off the coast of one of those states.
Yeah, they do. Huh? Yeah. Have you been to either?
I have not, but I've heard it's very similar to Southern California with weather. I think a little bit more humid, but yeah, it's pretty cool.
Remember we had next door neighbors for a while there that were from Wilmington?
Oh, yeah.
I think that I feel totally silly, but is that North Carolina or is that South?
Wilmington. The only thing I know about Wilmington is
there's
I think Michael Jordan was from there, maybe.
Oh, was he?
I think so.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. I thought that was a really important message to get out. I feel like we've had a week of this whole week or last week of doing shows are pretty much across the board all about spreading hope in different areas. And
yeah,
I feel like that's so important with such a lot of hopelessness in the world. And, you know, I understand the struggle with alcohol because for a while there, I definitely had too much wine. And like he was saying, you know,
but you know what though? It's so crazy. I don't even know. I mean, I think you thought you did, But the way I looked at it, I mean, I don't know that you really did. I mean, I don't know you.
I think for myself I did, knowing myself.
Really?
It wasn't a healthy relationship of why I was wanting it. And like he said, you know, I wasn't quite staggering my drinks. You know, I would come home from those days of doing hair just completely disgusted with everything going on around me. And, you know, I wouldn't appropriately drink that every half hour. I mean, the goal was to drink like a good glass and a half in the first half hour. And then you feel like you're okay to deal goal? With the rest of the night, you know, that kind of thing.
That was your goal?
Kind of without saying, I mean, without like, it's also subconscious, but
you don't say that. In
no,
your head,
but that's what you're doing. You're like, if I can just drink enough at the beginning to feel like I can enjoy the rest of my night, not think about what happened during the day. And that's the problem, I think, is that there was a little too much of that. And then I'd pace myself the rest of the night, but I just started feeling disgusting, you know?
It's funny. He said that a lot of people do it for sleep too. And whenever I've had too much to drink, I just fall asleep. Great, but then you wake up, you know, in the middle of the night and you can't go back.
Oh, it's the worst.
It's horrible for sleep. I don't understand. It seemed like it would be, you know, take Dr. Lester Grinspoon's advice, or not advice, but just I would take a little dab of
his opinion,
Rick Simpson's hemp oil, and that would help you sleep better, I would think.
I think there's gentler ways to stay asleep and have a better sleep cycle, because I think when the sugar interrupts your, you know, then we didn't even get into like the disruption of hormones, what that does. I mean, it's a pretty bad cycle that you can get into.
Dr. Massey, who's a friend of ours, says that on an autonomic level, you know, where, like if you measure the, Dr. Bergman has one of those machines where he measures your autonomic nervous system.
That's right.
And
right.
He says that the people he's seen, their cells are just going crazy. Like they're just freaking out.
And you mean people that drink?
People that drink,
drink too much or drink or like right anybody after you have a glass?
I think any amount of alcohol, your cells just freak out. Like if you can see them under a microscope, they just be going just vibrating probably crazy.
Mm.
And that's what's happening on an autonomic level and the nervous system level, but you can't really feel it because... maybe not until we get drunk. You know how it's like it takes 20 minutes for when you start eating to feeling full?
Yeah.
So people eat too much in the first 20 minutes and it's too much because they didn't eat slowly.
Mm-hmm.
It's probably like that. You don't feel it on an autonomic level or a physical level because it might take a little bit of time.
Yeah, for sure.
But he's saying your cells just freak out when you're drinking. It's weird though too, because I look at alcohol and it's like it's weird how we all have our own sort of issues and battles. And I think it was really important for him to say what he did during the show, is that it's not necessarily, you know, you're weak and blah blah blah. It's like, you know, we all have our own addictions and we all have our own issues. It's just somehow for some people it's alcohol. I'm just fortunate enough not to have that.
Yeah.
And I'm no better for not having that. It's just it's just different. Maybe I'm addicted to work or something else. You know?
Right,
but
right.
I just feel so bad because think about like the social acceptance with alcohol. And it's like you can go get alcohol, take home a bottle of wine after a bad day of work, or you can go out with friends. It's just everywhere.
I know.
And if you're trying to not drink, I mean, and you're, I don't know.
You almost have to put on blinders like a horse and just look at, you know, put your head down, and that's not living life. Mm-hmm. I feel like that's a band-aid. That's that internal struggle. I mean, I've had two friends pass away from alcohol, directly related to alcohol. And I think it was just that the struggle was too great, and they both sought tons and tons of help throughout the years. And I feel like that's when, like Dr. was saying today, like it's important to understand that you can actually change the physiology.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I think people don't understand. They think, okay, I can get the alcohol out of my body and then I'm just going to struggle the rest of my life with wanting it.
Constantly be just wanting to drink and I just can't.
Yeah. Yeah. And had those two people known that, they might still be here, because I think they both had a ton of willpower. Like, I think people don't give themselves enough credit.
Oh, yeah.
I think this is beyond willpower. It's like he said, there's this self-judgment that happens thinking that they can't control it and it's something's wrong with them. But man, I can completely understand that once your body gets whacked. I see my body being out of balance in some nutrition areas, what that does to me. Mm-hmm. I mean, my organs start hurting. Imagine when your brain is beyond like the marbles, like he said, the dysfunction of the marble jars, and you got a big problem.
Yeah.
And it's so sad because these people don't have a death wish. I mean, I don't think most people have a death wish. The thing is, they want to live and they want to live better.
They just want to numb the pain.
They're thinking alcohol's, you know, a solution to that. And
they just want to numb the pain.
Absolutely.
Man, that's...
Life is hard.
Yeah, and I understand in today's culture, I mean, it makes total sense. I mean, I don't blame people that drink at all because I completely understand. Like, you know, if your life is just going horrible and one bad thing after another and you're in debt and you're trying to balance all these things, you work a job you don't like and life is going horrible and all these bad things are happening, people are dying, people are getting in car crashes and you're, I mean, I can't say that I wouldn't do that either.
I
mean, it's like, why wouldn't you want to numb that pain? That's right. it's so difficult, you know, but I think a part of it too is people finding, I really think it has a lot to do with finding your mission in life.
Mm-hmm.
I really do.
Like, what is your purpose?
Cause if you're not happy doing what you're doing and it becomes a total burden for you and you just hate it and you want to numb the pain by, you know, imagine working at a job or a career that you hate. And you want to numb that pain every day after you get back and from work.
I've done that.
Yeah, you've done that.
It wasn't as bad as other people's, you know?
And then you got cocktail parties and work events that you have to go to.
And the holidays come around and then it's your anniversary and then it's always something to celebrate. I've realized. I realized that too. When I said, sorry to interrupt you, but a couple times there when I knew I was probably drinking a little too much for my own self and I'd say, you know, let me, what are you doing? Are you picking at me? My muscle?
I just like your little arm muscle.
I'm looking at my muscle as I'm talking.
I like
which
it.
I need to work on, by the way. But I'd always say, okay, well, today, you know, that's the last glass of wine. I ended on my birthday. Tomorrow I won't, you know, and then you're okay for a couple of weeks, and then it's someone else's birthday, and then it's the holidays, and then it's, you can always find a reason. I found that very strange. It overrides willpower in a way because you want to be a normal, quote, normal celebrator like everybody else.
Mm-hmm.
And they're all, you're thinking, all these people are normal, like, they seem to think this is a normal part of celebration. So it's hard to make a, like a draw line in the sand and say, this is it.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
I was listening to David Wolf the other day on The Best Day Ever. And he was talking about how, you know how we always make fun of him and them for making those superhero names.
Yeah.
Like David Avocado Wolf, Super Goji Girl and all this stuff. Well, he was saying that the reason why they do that is because they're sort of making a declaration that I am someone different.
Mm.
Like I'm a superhero. And so that's kind of cool because in a sense that like with this idea of justifying a new in 2 weeks is someone else's birthday and there's another work event or you got to give a speech and all this stuff, all these things will keep coming up. But I think having a grandiose sort of idea, kind of like what we talked about probably a year ago about having a mission statement for your life.
Yeah, yeah.
And just saying, this is who I am.
Writing your manifesto.
And this is what I stand for. And, you know, and so when a time comes around for you to have a drink or justify a drink, you're like, no, because this is not going to facilitate where I'm going in life, or this is not who I am.
Mm-hmm.
Like if everyone else is doing X, I'm going to do Y. And it's a complete restructuring of how you view yourself. You know?
You know what's funny about that you just said too? I completely agree. And I found in my own life, what's really interesting is that I can be swayed either way. It's like I'm always on a line.
Yeah.
And say I turn on the food channel, the Food Network, and they're drinking wine while they're cooking.
No, the food channel.
But it's easier to justify, like you're thinking, oh, everyone here is cooking and having a glass of wine and like, oh, this is normal. And then you're thinking, okay, so you have a glass of wine with your dinner and you don't feel that bad. Well, the next day, you know, you wake up and you start your day listening to a David Wolf interview. And you're like, oh, crap, he talks about my liver. Shoot, I shouldn't have had that yesterday. Now, why was I thinking? I'm not going to watch the Food Channel anymore, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Well, this is how normal people are. They, you know, the healthy people don't drink. So then you go over to that side and you camp out there for a while. And then you go to an anniversary party and you're like, oh, everyone here. So it's like this constant, like... It really, you are become, it's like, you know, your parents, you know, are afraid who you hang around in junior high is going to, who you're going to become.
Right.
Choose your friends wisely, you know, but it's kind of like what you choose to surround yourself with. Really, if you're going to, you know, be around raw, vegan, non-drinking people, chances are it's going to be easier for you to have those kinds of friendships and be around those social situations other than a bunch of people who love nerding out on food and drinking wine, you know?
Yeah.
And I just find it really interesting when you change your whole life and your purpose and find that. And it seems that it naturally kind of changes what you're around and what's going into your ears, mm-hmm. what's going into your eyeballs.
Yeah.
You know?
There's a couple of different aspects. We'll wrap up here really quickly. I want to tell people at the end too about the sauna sale, but there's a couple of different aspects of what you were just saying is that one is like restructuring how you view yourself and who you are and what your mission is on this planet. And that's really hard if you're doing a job you don't like and you have no idea what you want to do. But you can think about characteristics. Like you don't have to be thinking about vocation as much as, okay, what kind of person do I want to be? What kind of impact do I want to have in the world? When people walk away, my friends and family, from having spoken to me, what feeling do I want them to have? And so you can think, everyone can do that, whether or not they know, regardless of what they should do for a vocation. So one aspect is determining what kind of person you want to be. That anyone can do right away, and figuring out, okay, I'm a superhero, and this is what superheroes do. Mm. They take care of themselves, and you can come up with a whole thing about the standards that you will now live by. And then the other aspect is, okay, how do I take stock of my life now in view of what I've just determined about myself? Okay, I'm working a job I don't like and it requires me to travel. Okay. And it's, I always drink when I travel. Okay. So I need to talk to my boss and see if someone else can do these trips for me, or, you know, I need to hang out less with these friends or something like that. Then you can start taking stock of aspects of your life where you do drink.
Mm-hmm.
And then once you remove those, then you'll have more of this sort of idea in your mind that will facilitate believing who you say you are.
Mm.
You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And so once you can combine just that side of it, saying, you know, coming up with a roadmap of who you are, and then making small changes in how you live your life so that you don't have to be in situations where you would drink, then that's going to start garnering a little bit of success here and there.
Yeah.
And then that's going to be like, yeah, I am a superhero.
Right. Then it's a launch pad.
Yeah.
It's almost like it becomes a springboard, you mm-hmm. know, that's the springs become stronger every time and you can bounce higher and you're like, oh, this is good. Like
one last thing before we leave, I know we got to go, but, isn't it interesting? His idea about the more you drink, the more you, it sort of screws up those marbles in your brain, mm-hmm. For lack of a better term.
GABA.
Yeah. So that you keep craving more. It's like this continual process.
It makes sense.
Wow.
It makes sense.
Doesn't it?
Because why, I mean, if somebody doesn't want to drink, why do we keep drinking? It's clearly something has shifted.
It's bizarre.
I mean, addiction is very real. It's a very real thing. And I think the thing for people too is to not judge other people's process, because we don't understand people who don't have an alcohol addiction. I don't think we can even begin to understand
mm-hmm.
the struggle. So
mm-hmm.
I think it's important to be on that other side, to be that family and friend and person just rooting on the person who wants to change and is becoming honest about their struggle, you know, mm-hmm.
and celebrating victories.
Who needs to feel worse about becoming honest with what you want to change in your life? I mean, I think that's the most beautiful thing ever.
If no one will tell you or speak to you about things, you got to wonder how much judgment are you giving to people because people just won't open up to you. And it's important to celebrate people's victories and be their biggest fan, sharing them on the sideline and realize, you know, every now and then I'm going to have to stop along the side of the road and drink a thing of water and stop the marathon because I'm just exhausted. But the end game is I'm going to continue this marathon. And so realizing people are going to slip up and make mistakes, but being their biggest fan and celebrating their little victories along the way and making people really feel like they are a success, because that's what people want to feel like.
What I loved about Dr. Gibson was he was all about love. He said, we just got to start loving these people.
Mm-hmm.
Let's start showing love and then watch what happens.
Yeah, totally. Okay, his website is lastcallprogram.com. And if you're listening to this today, I'm hoping to have this up today. We are running a sale on our sauna. If you were interested.
And today, by the way, is July 11, 2016.
Good one.
Yes.
Good one.
Because today could be whenever anyone's listening.
Yeah, people listen to this like 3 years in the future or whatever.
Yeah.
July 11th, 2016. And we're going to be running the sale for 4 days through Thursday night at 11:59 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. We cannot advertise this on the website, so if you'd like to get one, simply email me and I'll give you all the instructions. Basically, you would make a donation on our page for a specific amount. It's actually $100 off right now, plus $25, which normally costs for shipping. So it's $125 off the normal
price.
For the
U.S.
For the continental U.S. If mm-hmm. you live outside of the continental U.S., Alaska, Hawaii, or anywhere else in the world, email me and I'll send you a shipping quote.
Perfect.
And if you are interested in these, I would highly recommend picking one up soon, because they do go out of stock and they do have to reorder. And sometimes that can take weeks. So last time so many people ordered them that that was an issue. So please take us up on this if you're interested in it. And you can also listen to episode 443 with Phil Wilson and I. We talked about the sauna. So in any event, thank you guys for listening, for being in our lives. We really appreciate it. We love you all so much. And we'll catch you guys on the next episode.
Hey, everybody. This is Josie, Justin's mom. Don't tell him, but I know he would absolutely be really happy if you would sign up to his free weekly newsletter. And don't forget to share this with all your friends. This is the Buzzing Bumblebee signing off.
That was so good.
Hello.
Oh my gosh.
No material on this blog is intended to suggest that you should not seek professional medical care. Always work with qualified medical professionals, even if you educate yourself in the field of live food, nutrition, and alternative medicine. I'm not a doctor, nor am I offering readers medical advice of any kind. None of the information offered here should be interpreted as a diagnosis of any disease, nor an attempt to treat or prevent any disease or condition. While information in this blog is discussed in the context of numerous conditions, it can be dangerous to take action based on any information in this blog or to start any health program without first consulting a health professional. The content found here is for informational purposes only and is in no way intended as medical advice, as a substitute for medical counseling, or as a treatment slash cure for any disease or health condition, and nor should it be continued as such. Always work with a qualified healthcare professional before making any changes to your diet, prescription drug use, lifestyle, or exercise activities. This information is provided as is, and the reader slash viewer assumes all risks from the use, non-use, or misuse of this information.